Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion of today's call. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Vivian White. You may begin.
Hi there, everybody. It's Vivian here from the Night Sky Network. We're really glad to be hosting another wonderful telecon this evening, and glad you're here with us. To begin with, let's make sure we're all on the same page. Tonight, we're going to be hearing from Dr. Don Yeomans, speaking to us about our smallest neighbors that are going to be big news in the sky this year. If you don't have the slides up in front of you, you can see them online at www.astrosociety.org/NSN Telecon. That's NSN like Night Sky Network. astrosociety.org/NSN Telecon. And if you have any problems along the way, feel free to email us at nightskyinfo@astrosociety.org. Okay, we're really excited to hear from Dr. Yeomans this evening, but before I introduce him, let's just take a minute to see who's calling in. Marnie Berenson's here on the line with me, and we're both calling in from the Astronomical Society of the Pacific in the San Francisco Bay Area. Hi, Marnie.
Hi, everybody. Great to hear from you. See you, something.
And so now we'll hear from you. The operator is going to open up the lines, and if you could tell us your name and where you're calling from once he gives the signal, all of your lines are going to be open. So here we go.
Dan Brown, Vice of Georgia.
Paul Cirillo, NJAA.
Astronomy Society.
Bruce Tinkler, ATMOB.
Joan Chamberlain, Astronomical Society of Northern New England.
Stuart Meyer, Selman Living Laboratory Observatory in Oklahoma.
Wesley Ferber, Miami Valley Astronomical Society.
Rick Tang, Eugene, Oregon.
Stuart Myers, Amateur Astronomers, Inc. in New Jersey.
Steve Schubert, Pensacola.
Joe Oscaro, Amateur Astronomers, Inc. in New Jersey.
Jim Bentling, Miami Valley, Ohio.
David Samuel,
Alan Zook,
California.
He bring me that
other phone. Bim Madimaran from Dallas, Fort.
Rick Marzek, Chicago Astronomical Society.
Chicago Astronomical Society of Rowan County, North Carolina.
Morris Museum Astronomical Society, New Jersey.
Darian O'Brien, the Darian
Tulare Astronomical Association,
Colorado.
Tulare, California.
Dick and Nancy Hodgson, Empire Astronomy Club, South Dakota.
Alan Zucksworth, Miami Valley Astronomical Society, Dayton, Ohio.
Russ Drum, Star Astronomy, New Jersey.
Jim Williams, East Central Minnesota Astronomy Club.
John Cox, Mountain Rest Astronomical Observatory.
Virginia Renahan, Amateur Telescope Makers of Boston.
Joe Tarkany, John Bryan State Park Observatory.
That's right.
John Younger, Hawaiian Astronomical Society, Land of Paradise. Belated Happy New Year.
Chris Michaels, Cedar Amateur Astronomers.
Brad Irish, Astronomical Society of Northern New England.
Jerry Adams, Dayton, Ohio, with the Miami Valley Astronomical Society.
Taylor Holmes, Charlie Elliott, Chapter of the Atlanta Astronomy Club.
Roman Self, Celestial Observers Guild.
Dan Davis, also Astronomy Club.
Oh, gosh, we have got so many people on the line tonight. I think we're going to have to close it up. We love hearing from all of you.
Charlie Rue, Amateur Astronomers Incorporated, New Jersey.
And talk.
Wow, what a crowd out there. Great, and are we all closed up?
Yes, all lines are muted.
Okay, it's so great to hear from everybody. I don't think we've had a crowd this large in a while. If this is your first teleconference with us, welcome. You're just going to follow along with the slides, and there's going to be a time for Q&A at the end. I want to remind everybody also to stick around after the presentation and the questions, because Dr. Yeomans is very kindly giving away a signed copy of his new book to one lucky listener tonight. We'll talk about that in a minute. So let me introduce you, Dr. Yeomans. He is the supervisor for the Solar System Dynamics Group at the NASA JPL Laboratory in Southern California. He also manages NASA's Near-Earth Object Program Office, and has helped lead missions such as Deep Impact, Epoxy, Contour, Hayabusa, anything that has to do with small solar system objects, he has been on, it seems. He's received countless awards from NASA and beyond, and Asteroid 2956 Yeomans is named in honor of his achievements. He is the author of over 170 research papers and four books, including his most recent, The Near-Earth Objects, Finding Them Before They Find Us. Dr. Yeomans is committed to making science palatable and available to the general public. In an interview with him, I read that he said, making complex science research crystal clear for the public is tough, but very necessary. Well, Dr. Yeomans, I know those of us in the amateur community can relate to that part of your work, and we're all very much looking forward to hearing about the asteroid part as well. Welcome. We're really glad you've joined us.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and it's nice to hear from folks all parts of the country. We've got a very wide distribution. Let's see. Tonight we're going to talk about near-Earth objects, which are basically comets and asteroids that are in the Earth's neighborhood. Technically, they're objects that can get within about 30 million miles of the Earth's orbit, so that's what a near-Earth object is. The first slide just introduces the talk. I'm moving on to the second slide, and this sort of summarizes just some of the physical characteristics of these objects. They're made of comets and asteroids. First, comets. Basically, they're weak and very black, icy dirt balls. They consist basically of a weak collection of talcum powder-sized silicate dust, a layer about a meter thick on the surface, and underneath that layer of dust you find mostly water ice. That's about 30% ices, mostly water ice. You also have carbon dioxide ice, dry ice, and carbon monoxide ices, some methane, ammonia, and other ices that are even less abundant, but mostly water ice underneath a very dusty black surface. And these objects, of course, when they get close to the sun, they start outgassing. The subsurface ices start vaporizing, and the gases start pouring off the cometary surface and dragging with them the dust particles that form the dust tails. And, of course, the gas is quickly ionized by the solar radiation and pushed in an anti-sunward direction by the pressure of sunlight, that's the dust, and also the charged particles are pushed backwards by the high-speed solar wind of charged particles coming off the sun at something like 400 kilometers a second. So you've got an icy nucleus, dirty ice nucleus. You've got dust trailing off in an anti-solar direction because of the pressure of sunlight, and you've got these gases that are being pushed back by very high-speed charged particles from the sun. On comets, they don't have much in the way of cratered surfaces because the dust, some of it, goes off the comet's nucleus and sets back down on the surface, filling in any craters. That's not so with asteroids, which run the gamut from comets that have already run out of gas, so to speak, and they're pretty wimpy ex-cometary fluff balls. You have asteroids that are shattered rock, rubble piles, solid rock, and all the way to solid slabs of iron. Some of you may have visited Meteor Crater in near Winslow, Arizona, and that object, or that crater rather, was formed by a 30-meter-sized nickel-iron impactor that collided with the Earth some 50,000 years ago and left traces of nickel-iron meteorites all the way around the surface of the crater. So if we move on to the third slide, I'd like to explain why the study of near-Earth objects is fairly recent. This is a slide showing what the inner solar system was like in 1800. Basically, you've just got Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and nothing in between. So if we move on to slide four, we move ahead 100 years, and so now we've discovered several minor planets between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, but still nothing in the Earth's neighborhood, nothing in the what we could call near-Earth objects. So there wasn't any concern, obviously. They weren't there in 1900, or we didn't find them, rather. So if we move on to the next slide, slide five, we move up 50 years to 1950, and we're finding more and more asteroids or minor planets between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, but still very few objects that we could classify as near Earth. So if we move to the next one, slide six, we're up to 1990, and of course, the number of asteroids between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter is increasing dramatically, but still, there's very few, relatively few, near-Earth objects. So I think you can see what's going on here. If we move to slide 7, we move up to 1999, and slide 8, we move up to just last year. And so the number of discoveries for near-Earth objects increased dramatically in the 1990s, because that's when NASA started paying attention and supporting ground-based observatories that did nothing but look for near-Earth objects. We have the Catalina Sky Survey near Tucson, Arizona. We have the Linear Program Office program near Socorro, New Mexico. There's the Pan-STARRS 1.8-meter telescope on Maui, Hawaii. These are the primary observatories that are currently discovering near-Earth objects. Catalina Sky Survey, Linear Group near Socorro, New Mexico, and the Pan-STARRS Group on top of Haleakala on Maui, Hawaii. So really, what's the importance of these objects? Well, they're important from a number of points of view. First of all, science, then future space resources. We're hearing a lot about that recently. Human exploration, it's President Obama pointed out in was April 2010 that one of the goals of NASA should be to have a human exploration of an asteroid as sort of a stepping stone to the human exploration of Mars. Mars, of course, is the ultimate destination for human exploration, but rather than taking that giant leap and a several-year mission, it would make sense to first go to a near-Earth asteroid with humans, which only would take about 6 months round trip, which would be a much easier mission. You could test the technologies, try and understand the radiation dosages that were possibly affecting the astronauts, and see whether astronauts really, two or three of them, could survive without strangling each other in a small confined area for a period of 6 months. And then planetary defense, of course, is an important component of this. That's usually what we hear about. So if we move on to slide 10, this is an artist's conception by Bill Hartman, who is also an astronomer in Arizona and a space artist. This is his conception of what the solar system might have looked like 4.5 billion years ago. In the center, of course, the sun, the nascent sun, is forming. In the inner solar system, the rocky bits and pieces are agglomerating into the planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and the leftover bits and pieces from the inner solar system formation process are what we now call asteroids. And in the outer solar system, you've got the icy bits and pieces that were agglomerating to form the major planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and the leftover bits and pieces from that formation process are what we now call comets. So if you wish to study the chemical mix and the thermal environment under which our solar system formed some 4.5 billion years ago, then you'd like to study comets and asteroids, because they haven't changed a great deal in the intervening 4.5 billion years. So you can understand a great deal of how our solar system formed just by investigating the chemical compositions of these objects. So if we move on to slide 11, I mentioned that these objects are human-accessible targets. They, in terms of the energy required to get to them and back, some of these near-Earth asteroids are actually easier to reach than the Moon itself because they have such low gravity. You can land easily and return easily from these objects. You don't have that gravity well at the Moon to get out of. So some of these objects are extremely accessible. Some of them are in orbits that are similar to that of the Earth, and those are the ones that are at the same time the easiest to get to and the most threatening. So those are what we call potentially hazardous asteroids. So these objects are possible candidates for human exploration, as we mentioned. They can also be mined. Some of them have hydrated minerals and subsurface ices that could be reduced to water. You need water for surviving in space, of course, and you could break the water down into hydrogen and oxygen, which is the most efficient form of rocket fuel. So someday, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the road, these near-Earth objects may well serve as the watering holes and fueling stations for interplanetary exploration. Now, most people think of near-Earth asteroids, they think of the risks. And we do attend to these risks on this website, neo.jpl.nasa.gov/risk. And it's our job to take the observations of these, the astrometric observations of these asteroids and comets that are sent to the Minor Planet Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they turn around and send those observations to us. And it's our job to compute precision orbits and run their orbits 100 years into the future to see if any of them make interesting close Earth approaches. And if they do, then it's our job to compute impact probabilities. How likely is it that one of these objects will collide with the Earth in the next 100 years? So we have what we call the Sentry system, that actually the observations are sent automatically from the Minor Planet Center to our computer Sentry system. The Sentry system takes those observations 24/7 and updates the orbits, runs them out 100 years into the future, and produces new close Earth approaches and impact probabilities. So it's done automatically without our having to monitor it day and night. So if we move on to slide 13, we get to the working telescopes that we mentioned earlier. There's a Linear project. It's a one-meter telescope near Socorro, New Mexico. The Catalina Sky Survey, they have a 0.7 and a 1.5-meter telescope near Tucson, Arizona, and the Pan-STARRS 1.8-meter atop Haleakala in Maui, Hawaii. So these are the three primary discovery telescopes. During most of 2010 and the early part of 2011, we also had a NEOWISE spacecraft in Earth orbit that was looking for near-Earth objects in the near-infrared. The infrared is actually the ideal wavelength to look for these objects because they're dark and they radiate primarily at the 10-micron wavelength level. And if you're operating in the infrared, you don't have as many stars for background confusion, and you don't have phase effects. These objects radiate heat, which is what you're seeing in the infrared, of course, and they're not affected by where in its orbit this object is. So the near-infrared is actually the ideal wavelength region to look for near-Earth objects. You can't do it easily from the ground because, of course, the water vapor in the Earth's atmosphere will cut down on the infrared signal. So we had the NEOWISE up there for, what was it, better part of a year, and they found 135 near-Earth objects, 22 comets. And but more importantly, they allowed us to sort of calibrate the size frequency distribution of asteroids. So that is, how many objects do we have that are 30 meters and larger? How many objects do we have that are 100 meters? How many objects do we have that are 1 kilometer and larger? And that turns out to be about 1,000. And we've already discovered 94% of those objects, which was a congressional mandate. So we've finally achieved that goal of finding 90% of the near-Earth objects larger than 1 kilometer. Now, 1 kilometer is sort of a borderline. 1 or 2 kilometers or larger, if it were to hit the Earth, would be likely to cause global problems, and anything smaller than 1 or 2 kilometers would be causing regional damage. So 1 or 2 kilometers is sort of the dividing line between local problems and global problems. So if we move on to the slide 14, once we find these objects, we'd like to get the two planetary radars on them as soon as we can, if that's possible. There are two planetary radars that are capable of sending a radar signal to an asteroid and receiving the bounce from that asteroid. The first one is located in Goldstone, California, in the Mojave Desert. It's a 70-meter dish, fully steerable. It can look from horizon to horizon. The other planetary radar that is active is in Arecibo, Puerto Rico. That's a 305-meter antenna that is capable of looking at the zenith and 20 degrees on either side of its zenith. So it cannot look from horizon to horizon, but it is far larger and far more sensitive than the Goldstone antenna. So these two radars are actually complementary. They can you can send a signal to an asteroid, bounce it off, and measure the time it took for you to send that signal to the asteroid and the time between send and receive signal, and you know the speed of light, so you can determine to within a few meters the position of that asteroid or the range of that asteroid from your antenna. And you also get the so-called range rate, or the velocity that object is making along your line of sight. So you get sort of a Doppler shift. And with the range and Doppler shift observations, we can actually back out models, shape models, three-dimensional shape models. You see one down in the lower left, a shape size for a 6489 Galevka. It's a false color showing some of the slopes on the surface. So this object is about 300 meters from end to end, and you can see there's all kinds of detail here. In fact, recently the Goldstone antenna is capable of 4-meter resolution, which is spatial resolution, which is incredible. It's far better than the Hubble Space Telescope can do. It's far better than anything that can be done on the ground. It's far better than flyby missions. The only thing that can compare with the spatial resolution of the Goldstone radar antenna is an actual rendezvous mission where you come up next to a comet or an asteroid and take images of it. So with 4-meter spatial resolution on our radars, we're getting extraordinary shape models. And on the lower right, you see a shape model of 66391 1999 KW4. It's a binary system. It's about the major component is about a kilometer and a half across, and you can notice it has a satellite. About 16% of the nearest asteroids have satellites. And how this happens, you can see that this object, 1999 KW4, is shaped sort of like a muffin. It's rotating rather rapidly. And the object is sort of a rubble pile, so material that is at the poles sort of rolls downhill and is spun off from the equatorial region, and then it agglomerates into the satellite. So you can see that it's got a spreading waistline, like some of us. And this is how we think that the asteroid satellites form. The material of a very rapidly rotating primary rolls downhill to the equatorial region, and then is thrown off and reagglomerates into the satellite. There's actually two near-Earth asteroids that have two moons. So that was a bit of a surprise. So many of these objects do have satellites. So if we move on to the next slide, which is 15, this is sort of what we do at NASA's Near Earth Object Program office here at JPL in Southern California. As I mentioned, we get data from the Minor Planet Center and do automatic orbit updates, and then we run them forward for 100 years, the orbits, to see if any of them represent a threat. We have a relational database for orbital data and physical characteristics, if they exist. And then we've been studying some deflection strategies. What would we do if we actually found an object that was on an Earth-threatening trajectory? And one of the easiest techniques for deflecting it, if you find it early enough, of course, is to simply run into it with a spacecraft, slow it down a millimeter or two per second, change its orbital period so that in 10, 20, or 30 years, when it was predicted to hit the Earth, it would miss by a wide margin. So that is the simplest and, to my mind, the best way to deflect a near-Earth asteroid that has our name on it. We also have an outreach site, www.jpl.nasa.gov/asteroid watch, one word, where you can download a widget that you can put on your computer that will give you the, for any day, the next 5 close Earth approaches that are coming up. So you can be the first on your block to know what's coming up next. And our technical website is neo.jpl.nasa.gov, and there you can get an introduction to near-Earth objects as well, and also an interactive orbital diagrams for all objects, over 600,000 of them. You can get a list of close Earth approaches in the past, present, and future. You can get our risk page, which will tell you which objects we're watching most closely because we cannot yet rule out an Earth impact. So there's a host of, and finally there's a page that actually shows which near-Earth objects are most accessible by spacecraft, which ones are in Earth-like orbits and are easiest to reach and return from. So NASA is very interested in robotic and possibly human exploration of these near-Earth objects. So we mentioned the human exploration target identification, which near-Earth asteroids are desirable. This is slide 16. Which ones are next observable, both by optical techniques and by radar. So we have a list of not only of those objects that are most accessible by spacecraft, but also when are they next observable in the optical region and when are they next observable by radars. We did a deflection mission study for asteroid 2011 AG5, which at one time had an impact probability of 1 in 500 for February 5th of 2040, but observations made in Hawaii late last year allowed us to refine the orbit of that object to such an extent that we can now rule out that possible impact in February of 2040. So that was, we sounded the all clear on that particular object. We also have an educational site for designing asteroid deflection missions that is coming. It's not yet up on the site, but it'll soon be up, and you'll be able to, we've got some simulated Earth impactors, and you'll be able to design missions to run into these objects and see whether you can do it in time to save Earth. So that's sort of a thinking man's computer game. Let's see. If we move on to slide 17... This is the orbital illustration for 2011 AG5, the one we just called an all-clear. You can see it. The dark blue orbit of the asteroid intersects the Earth's orbit at the 10 o'clock position right there, and that is February 5th. But that object cannot strike the Earth on February 5th of 2040, so we called an all-clear on that one. Now, if we move on to slide 18, this was the so-called uncertainty region for this asteroid, 2011 AG5. We've got the Earth in the center here, and we've got this long line that's going from left to right that represents the possible positions of the asteroid before the observations were made in late 2012. So while the nominal position of the asteroid is about a half inch off to the left of Earth, possible positions of the asteroid in 2040 could be anywhere along this very long line. So when we got additional observations, if we move to slide 19, you can see that the uncertainties dramatically decreased, and now the only positions that the asteroid could take on February 5th of 2040 are noted here with a small line denoted the region of uncertainty, which no longer includes the Earth. So that was the reason why we called the all clear. So that's basically the technique that we use. If the orbit's not well determined, very often it would be possible for some of these orbits to strike the Earth. But as we get more and more data, we can refine the orbits and decrease the uncertainties and then rule out these possible Earth impacts. So if we move on to slide 20, this is near-Earth object Apophis. You may have heard of this one. It has a predicted close approach on April 13th, 2029. That's actually Friday, the 13th of 2029. It's no longer 270 meters. Some recent observations suggest that it's about 325 meters. And this object will actually pass close enough to the Earth on April 13th, 2029, so that it's actually going to pass within the geosynchronous ring of weather and communication satellites that will be announcing its arrival. It'll be a naked eye object for folks in Europe, but not the U.S. So this object, at one point, had a possibility of striking us in April 13th, 2029, or April 13th, 2036, which turns out to be Easter Sunday. So we had Mother Nature fooling with us here a little bit. But we had additional optical observations in late last year and additional radar observations that were made early this year that allowed us to refine the orbit of this object and rule out completely any possible Earth impact in 2036 or 2029. So if we move on to slide 21, we have asteroid 2012 DA14 that's going to get very close to the Earth on February 15th of this year. And this is a diagram I ripped off from Sky and Telescope that, with their permission. So it shows in the upper illustration the Earth's orbit and the orbit of 2012 DA14. And in the lower diagram, you see the same orbits face on. Now, they both have an orbital period of 1 year, which means that 2012 DA14 is going to be hanging around for quite a while and causing possible problems. But on February 15th of this year, it's going to pass very close to the Earth. It will not hit the Earth, cannot hit the Earth. And let me see if we can go on to slide 22 here. For those folks who wish to try and observe it, I'm afraid the U.S. is out of luck for observing this object during its closest approach. You can see that it goes from the deep south to the north rather quickly, and it'll be observable. The close approach will be observable for observers in Eastern Europe, Asia, and Australia. All right, if we go to slide 23, you can see the orbital path of, as seen from the Earth, the orbital path of this asteroid as it passes within the geosynchronous ring of communication satellites and weather satellites. It's actually passing within the Earth of a distance of 4.4 Earth radii off the Earth's surface. So this is a record close approach for an object of this size. This is about a 45-meter-sized object, about the same size object that caused such destruction in Siberia back in 1908, the so-called Tunguska event. So this would be equivalent to that object in terms of its destructive capability. Perhaps you remember that or note that this Tunguska event actually leveled millions of trees in the Siberian forest for about 720 square miles. So an object of this size can cause significant damage should it hit. But, again, this object cannot hit. We know its orbit well enough that it can't hit the Earth. And it's passing within the distance of the geosynchronous satellites, so it can't hit those. The only possibility is it could knock out a GPS satellite, but we're providing a file of predictions where this object will be to satellite providers, and they can compute how close this object will get to any of their satellites. It's extremely unlikely that there will be any problems with this object hitting any satellites. So what would we do if we did find an object that was on an Earth-threatening trajectory? Well, we've already demonstrated that we have the technology and the navigational skills to run a spacecraft purposely into a near-Earth object. Here you see the Deep Impact mission on July 4th, 2005, where we purposely ran a spacecraft into Comet Tempel 1 to try and understand its composition and its structure. And this had to be done autonomously with a very smart impacting spacecraft. So I show this just to demonstrate that we have the technology to actually run into these objects and deflect them if we find them early enough. And this would be one of the primary techniques for deflecting an object that was, in fact, on an Earth-threatening trajectory. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about Comet Ison, which is coming, I'm sure you all know. Later this year, reaches perihelion on Thanksgiving Day and is going to be observable, easily observable, in the morning and evening sky, especially the evening sky at, right after sunset in the west. This is another illustration showing Ison shortly after sunset, November, December of this year. It should be easy naked eye object. Mind you, comets are notoriously difficult to predict in terms of their activity. But if this comet behaves itself, and it is fresh from the so-called Oort cloud, so it's a new comet, and likely has very volatile ices still intact, not just water ice, but probably carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, ammonia, methane. So the radar, not the radar, but the radio and optical astronomers will be looking at this object very carefully to try and understand the chemical composition of a brand new comet fresh from the Oort cloud. Actually, you're probably all aware that there's a comet, Pan-STARRS, that's due to be easily observable with a naked eye in March, in the morning, in the evening western sky as well. So, if you get Sky and Telescope, and I'm betting most of you do, there's a nice article in this month's edition. So, in summary, these near-Earth objects are important because they, from a science point of view, because they are the least changed objects from our solar system's formation process. They are likely the objects that brought to the early Earth much of the water and carbon-based materials that allowed life to form in the first place, and subsequent collisions punctuated evolution, allowing only the most adaptable species, that's us, to progress further. Down the road, decades from now, we may well be using these objects as fueling stations and watering holes for interplanetary exploration, so they're important for our future. And finally, we need to find them before they find us if we are to have a future. Thanks very much for your interest.
Dr. Yeomans, thank you so much. That was fantastic. I learned a lot. And it sounds like we may be in for a really interesting year ahead with near-Earth objects and comets coming our way. Next, let's open the line up to you all to questions. Operator?
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Mm-hmm. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
And I just, while we're waiting for those to come up, I want to mention quickly that these events are a really great time to pull out your Space Rocks toolkit and use some of these activities to explain what's going on to the public. You can also find the Cook Up a Comet activity on the Night Sky Network website. Just look under Astronomy Activities and Query on Comets. All right, so do we have any questions in line?
Yes, the first question is from Paul Cirillo. Your line is open.
Hi, Don. Thanks for the presentation.
Well, you're welcome.
I often use the encounter that we had in 2008 with object TC3, the one that was first identified at Mount Lemmon, and then within like a day or so it came into the Sudan.
Right.
That always makes for a very interesting presentation with all the events that happened from first sighting to entry into the atmosphere. Can you think of any other recent encounters we've had with something like that that would make for a good show and tell?
Well, there was that object that collided in South America that created a very small crater. But that object that you referred to, TC3, is really the only object for which we have been able to discover in advance of an impact and predict where and when it would impact. And as you know, folks actually went and gathered some very rare meteorites from that event as a result of the impact. So that was a boon for science. And that impact prediction, as you pointed out, took place less than 24 hours after the discovery of the object. And we managed to predict where it would hit, when it would hit, and get an informational notice out to the State Department and went to the White House. It went all over the federal government, all within the space of 24 hours. So the system works. But it's apart from Tunguska and that one, there's not too many others that have taken place in recent times.
Okay. Well, in a sense, I guess that's good. Thank you very much.
The next question is from Darian O'Brien.
Dr. Yeoman, thank you very much for your presentation. Very interesting. I had two questions. One is, you had mentioned the observatory that we had in space called NEOWISE. I was curious what happened to that program and to that telescope. And then the second question I had was, if you guys do identify or is there anything that amateur astronomers can do in terms of the search for near-Earth objects to help with the Linear, the Catalina, and the Pan-STARRS programs? Or is there anything planned for another NEOWISE satellite in the near future? And is there anything that amateur astronomers can do to aid and help with the discovery of these objects?
Well, yeah. In fact, your question is quite timely. I was just reading a proposal that would put NEOWISE back in action. As you know, the NEOWISE satellite ran out of cryogens, so two of the four infrared bands were no longer useful. But even the two that remain and are usable without cryogens would be excellent for discovering and characterizing these near-Earth objects. And there is a proposal, as I mentioned, that to NASA, if they choose to fund it, that would put that satellite back online with those two infrared bands for another 3 years. So we got our fingers crossed that NEOWISE is simply taking a nap and will be soon awakened to find more objects. To your second question, amateurs are already helping. They are a huge part of the near-Earth object program. Without them, this program would not be a success, and not in the sense that they do many discoveries. Not many amateurs have 1.5-meter telescopes, to be sure. But once an object is discovered, the critical follow-up observations allow us to compute orbits and secure them and make sure that we can predict where they'll be in the future. So getting back to that TC3 that collided in October of 2008, something like 26 different amateur astronomers provided hundreds of observations, all within a space of a couple of hours. So they were critically important for predicting where that object would hit. So the amateur community is already doing an enormous job and doing it quite well.
Thank you.
This is Vivian. I just want to also mention that the OSIRIS-REx project has got a target asteroids project that's an opportunity for amateurs to participate in kind of a citizen science project that contributes to more basic understanding of the near-Earth objects. So that's on there, too. It's at arizona.edu. You can find it on OSIRIS, O-S-I-R-I-S, REx, their website.
Right. That's a good point. It's not just astrometric observations that the amateurs provide. It's photometry to understand the rotation periods, they do a lot of that work, and they, again, they do it very well.
Yeah. Peyton, do we have any more questions?
Yes. The next question will be from Alan Zuckworth.
Alan,
your
there?
Line is open.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Yep. Hello. This is Alan Zuckworth. Dr. Yeomans, thank you for the presentation. I enjoyed the presentation. Your last slide has got near Earth objects, finding them before they find us. Is that a book that you've published? And if it is it available yet?
Yes, it is available. It's published by Princeton University Press. It's easily available through Amazon.com, which is you can actually get it discounted there for something on the order of $15, I think. Anyway,
okay. And I just have one other comment. You didn't mention the Planetary Defense Conference in Flagstaff, Arizona, coming up in April.
Yes, you're quite right.
That's why you might mention that for people that might be interested in going to that conference.
Yes, that's right. There is a Planetary Defense Conference. It's going to take place in Flagstaff in April. We'll be discussing the discovery and characterization of these objects, what could be done to mitigate an Earth impact. There's all kinds of activities being planned. It's going to be a good one. And there's also a tour being planned for Meteor Crater, which would be by someone who knows the crater well. So that's added incentive for folks to attend that conference.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the presentation. I appreciate your answering my questions. Thank you.
Sure.
And the next question is from Steve Meyer.
Hi. Yes. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much for the talk. I enjoyed it. A question that I typically get at programs, people like to know details. And in one of your slides and in your talk, you said that these comets are primarily made up of carbon dioxide and then water. I guess my question is, what are the reasons why there might not be other compounds and greater percentages of other elements?
Okay, that's a good question. The way I usually answer that question is to note that the most abundant element in the universe and solar system is hydrogen. The next most abundant element is helium, which doesn't combine easily with anything, so it's sort of a standoffish. And the third most plentiful element is oxygen. So hydrogen can't combine with helium, but it can easily combine with oxygen, so that's why there's so much water ice in the outer solar system. There's water ice everywhere in the solar system, in the outer solar system where the sun's radiation can't vaporize it over time. So that's why you see the comets made up primarily of water. And the more volatile species, like carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, as a comet goes by the sun time and time again, the most volatile ices are depleted first because, well, they're the most volatile. And water ice is the least volatile of those ices, so it doesn't vaporize as quickly. So over time, the volatile ices are expended and leaving only the water ice. And then when the water ice is gone, of course, your comet turns into an asteroid. So that's the short course.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And the next question is from Joe Growlick.
Question answered. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe.
The next question is from Greg Halleck.
Hi. Thank you very much for the talk. Quick question. On the Goldstone antenna, you said the resolution was 4 meters.
It can be.
At what distance is that?
Well, and that depends on how large the object is, of course. But typically, radar observations are made with the Goldstone antenna out to about a tenth of an AU or so.
they can resolve a four-meter feature at a tenth of an AU?
That's correct. That's
okay,
correct.
Thanks.
Wow.
And the next question is from Robert Burgess.
Dr. Ehrmans, thanks very much for the presentation. I had a question about, I guess it's slide 8. Does that represent objects that are estimated to be, you know, a kilometer in size, or does that include smaller ones? And I was wondering, what's the next phase for trying to find even smaller objects that could do a lot of damage?
Well, yeah. Slide 8 shows all asteroids that have been discovered. I don't really know whether they're all there, but it was just designed to show how dramatic the increase in discoveries were beginning in the 1990s. What was your second question? I'm sorry.
What are the next steps for smaller objects to try to locate those? Is it more of the same, or is there
right.
permissions or thoughts about doing that?
Yeah, Congress asked NASA to look for 90% of the 1 kilometer and larger objects, and we managed that goal. And so Congress has come back and asked that NASA now find 90% of 140-meter sized objects and larger, and we're about 40% from reaching that goal. 140 meters was selected because it would further reduce by 90% the threat remaining after the 1 kilometer and larger objects had been discovered. And it's also approximately the size of an object that could cause a tsunami were it to hit in the ocean.
Yep. Thank you.
The next question is from Stuart Myers.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking the time to do the presentation tonight.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Yeah, my comment is that whenever people talk about, you hear on the science shows and stuff, people talking about possible cosmic impacts, they all seem to assume that the impactor is this large, single, monolithic object, despite the fact that we have good evidence that a lot of the asteroids in this neck of the woods are rubble piles.
That's
which
right.
would most likely start breaking up due to the tidal effects of Earth's gravity before they even got to the atmosphere.
Well, yeah, your point is well taken. Most asteroids in near-Earth space are indeed rubble piles that have been battered by other collisions and re-agglomerated into objects that are no longer whirling rocks, but objects that are held together by not too much more than their own self-gravity. So if an object of that nature were to come into the Earth's atmosphere, the tidal effects, if it were large enough, could separate some of those pieces from the others, and you get a sort of a shotgun effect instead of a single bullet. But still, the energy of that object would be substantial, so it wouldn't diminish by much the threat. But it would, in fact, be important to recognize the possibility of a rubble pile if you were trying to deflect it.
As I say, because I think, in fact, we may have already had an experience with something like that back about 100 years ago.
Oh, you're talking about the Tunguska event of 1908?
No. I'm talking about Chance Precession of 1913, where all these objects were seen going like in a straight line.
Oh, I mean, across the sun? Is that what you're...
No, they had a big article in Sky and Telescope about it. And about in 1913...
Oh, the meteor stream.
Yeah, this thing was going in a straight line.
That's right.
And what I suspect was it was like essentially what happened with Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Yeah, and that could be, actually.
Scale.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a relatively small object, but your point is well taken. It probably did break up, it did fragment, as many asteroids do, and they follow one another, in this case, past the Earth.
Yeah. But my point is, though, that the fragments most likely would be of the size that explode in the upper atmosphere like every month or so, according to the military.
Yeah, that's right. If it's an object smaller than about 30 meters, it's going to cause a fireball or a bolide and won't really cause any ground damage. So it has to be larger than about 30 meters and a stony object, 30 meters and larger. So, yeah, but we can't really assume that all of these objects are rubble piles and will fragment into pieces that won't do any damage.
What was is that they don't seem to be, you don't seem to see too much discussion about the effects of rubble piles. That's my point.
Ah, well, there is an increasing number of talks about just whether how many objects, what percentage of the population are rubble piles, and what indeed would be the most effective technique for deflecting an object of that type. So, yeah, the fact that asteroids are probably rubble piles is a fairly new concept within the last several years. So it's getting a lot more attention recently.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question.
And the next question will be from Patrick O'Brien.
Hello, Dr. Yeoman. Can you hear me?
I can.
Well, thanks for the presentation. That was good presentation you made. And I have two questions. One is on slide 11. It shows the human accessible targets. And I was wondering if that means, have you ever heard of asteroid mining?
Yeah.
And that was one question about asteroid mining. And also, has the computation been allowing when the Earth, the gravitational pull of the Earth for and NEOs approaching the Earth, is that also considered to disallow the strikage of the Earth? So those
okay.
are the two questions that I have, Dr. Lee Yeoman.
Okay, very good. You mentioned the possibility of mining asteroids. That has been in the news fairly often recently. There's two companies that have started up in hopes of eventually mining asteroids, not necessarily for mining the platinum group elements and bringing them back to Earth. That probably wouldn't be cost effective. But if you're going to build structures in space or you're going to use asteroids or comets as fueling stations, then you would want to send preliminary missions to these objects to see which objects are most easily mined, which ones are richest in hydrated minerals and ices. So there is an increasing interest in mining these asteroids. I question whether their business model is would allow a return on investment anytime soon, but nevertheless, eventually there will be substantial interest in human mining of asteroids for space structures and for water resources and rocket fuel. And to answer your second question, yes, we not only take the Earth's gravity into account for these impact calculations, but the moon's gravity and the fact that the Earth is not spherical, so and neighboring asteroids as well. So we take into account the perturbative effects of not only the planets, but also the moons of the planets, and also several tens of the largest asteroids.
Well, thanks, Dr. Yeoman, and I'm calling from the Darien O'Brien Astronomy Club.
Thanks, Patrick. That's great. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this evening. But before we go, I want to thank our speaker. Thank you so much, Dr. Yeoman. This is a great talk. And I know that everyone's excited to sign up for the drawing of his new book, Near Earth Objects, Finding Them Before They Find Us. I see it's gotten really great reviews, and you can get it on the Kindle. But tonight, our speaker is giving away a signed copy, so thank you for that as well. Let's go ahead and clear the lines. And if the operator will tell us how to call in, why don't we take the 10th caller who calls in? Can you do that for us, operator?
Yes, please press star 1 to enter the drawing.
And if you could just let us know when we hit 10 and who that might be, that would be wonderful.
And it looks like it's going to be Ram White.
Excellent. Ram White, congratulations. If you would like to send us an email to the Night Sky Network, you can do that. Otherwise, we'll try and contact you. I think I know where to find you. Congratulations. And that's all for tonight. You can find this teleconference, along with many others, on the Night Sky Network under Astronomy Activities. You just search for teleconferences. And tonight's presentation with full audio and written transcript will be posted by the end of next week, with any luck. Thank you again, Dr. Yeomans, and good night, everyone. Clear skies.
Good night.